Hey, welcome back to the Bill Bennett Show. It's the podcast that takes an honest look at the current administration and the news of the day, and we get behind and under and over the news. On today's podcast, we speak with John Walters. He's the Chief Operating Officer of the Hudson Institute and the Director of Hudson Institute Political Studies. We're going to talk about this new and dangerous synthetic marijuana hitting the streets. A few weeks ago, over 70 people overdosed in New Haven, Connecticut. You might have seen these people on the ground in tremors and shakes. We'll get John's expertise. What's going on? Then Tom Joslin will give us an update on the war on terror. He's senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and he's the senior editor at the Long War Journal. Last but not least, we'll check in with Phil Steele as college football kicks off this weekend. We'll get his thoughts on some of the big games in the first few weeks of the season.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
All right, let's get things started with John Walters. He's the COO of the Hudson Institute and director of Hudson Institute Political Studies. He's former drug czar of the United States, director of Office of National Drug Control Policy, longstanding colleague and friend of mine. John, how are you?
Good. Good to talk to you, Bill. And I'm kind of czar squared here.
Czar squared. Yeah, I think that we were called worse than that, too.
Yeah. A lot of that stuff still on the internet.
I want to talk to you about this horrible drug issue we're talking about, problem in the United States. About a week ago, 10 days ago, watching TV, beautiful, clear day, sunny day in New Haven. A horrible picture of people in a park in the green there in New Haven, lying on the ground, convulsing, looked like epileptic seizures. Police, medical people trying to move these people into some kind of health care, into some kind of facility to calm them down. And we hear numbers, 70 people, 80 people or something intoxicated themselves with, is it synthetic marijuana or is it fentanyl? What happened in New Haven, John, your former drug czar? What happened?
Well, all I see is press reports. We don't have the old connections to real-time government information. But what you hear is that something sold as a kind of, you know, over-the-counter or legally sold synthetic marijuana. But this isn't the first time this kind of thing happened. Has happened in Louisiana a few years ago. It's happened in other places where, you know, these things, there's not one thing in these substances across all these different instances, but there's a batch that's made by people that claims to be frequently called, you know, synthetic marijuana, spice, K2, and has various toxins in it. I mean, the line between what makes you high and what makes you crippled or dead is very fine in these kinds of substances because they're an assault on the nervous system of individuals. So you put something in these substances that causes euphoria, intoxication, unconsciousness, and a little bit, depending on how concentrated these are, a little bit too much, and terrible consequences happen. So that's kind of what happened here. Now, there's a particular drug that's been associated with this particular batch, but some of this has come from the past from China, that's what they saw in the case of some of these, like Louisiana, I believe, where packets were shipped in. But it's mixtures of something that will burn or something that you can ingest with various chemicals, and you just saw a batch there where overdose and unconsciousness happened on a wide scale.
Is this connected at all? Said synthetic marijuana. Do we connect this up causally or in any other way with the effort to legalize marijuana all over the country? Or does it cut the other way? I've heard some people say, well, see, these poisonous substances that were added, you know, if you made this stuff legal, then you'd have Food and Drug Administration, you'd have control, and you couldn't put poison in these things. So maybe we should just make all this stuff legal. What's the connection? Which way does it cut?
Well, I think we have the brute fact of there's never been more legal marijuana, and this is still going on. Criminal behavior, poisons, you can see this. Even there have been reports since legalization in Colorado where people have taken samples of stuff being even sold in these so-called legal, not federal, by federal federal law legal, but they've been tolerated, these storefronts where, you know, there's agricultural chemicals from the growing, there's mold, there's other things in these substances. Again, the argument is it'll be better, cleaner, no crime if we legalize. In fact, there's more crime that's not cleaner. The criminals use this as a lower risk environment to conduct criminal activity.
Okay, again, that's a key phrase there. It's a lower risk environment. It's already a very permissive environment, laissez-faire environment. Go ahead.
Well, and once you make people addicted, they're looking for the cheaper high. And other arguments, well, we're going to legalize this and tax it. Well, you tax it, you increase the cost. The actual cost of making some of these things can be dropped dramatically. But, you know, if you don't pay your taxes, it's cheaper. And one of the biggest smuggled things around the world is cigarettes, because they're avoiding the taxes on cigarettes.
Yeah.
So, the argument here that crime goes away when you legalize an addictive substance is false, and demonstrably false. You see the manifestation of these casualties, unfortunately. But the pervasive use, the idea that you should have more people accept as normal getting high and even getting to the point of risking their lives for the level of these substances they're putting in their body. Once you make that more pervasive, you're going to have a terrible situation in our communities, and you're seeing that now. I mean,
we have the body count now from last year, went up from the year before. What was it, 72,000 died? Is that right?
Yeah, that's still an estimate based on, you know, some of the data. I've been frustrated. I've written some things about, you know, the Centers for Disease Control is not treating this as a real epidemic. Show us where it is. Show us what's happening week by week. I mean, you and I worked on health policy for education during Reagan when we had HIV/AIDS, and CDC was putting out weekly reports of where are new cases, what's happening with deaths. It was a terrible situation, but we began to be able to mobilize a response because we had real-time data and people were paying attention. We have many more people dying from drug overdoses now, and we're getting reports that are not only months, but it had been in the past a year out of date. That you can't mobilize resources. You can't mobilize local people. You can't figure out where the epidemic's spreading. You can't figure out what's working and slowing it down and what's needed if you don't look at the problem. And we ought to do this on the supply side and have real-time data, and we ought to blend it with real epidemic, and we ought to know how many were the non-fatal overdoses, who's coming into hospital emergency rooms, that system's been collapsed, who's coming in for treatment, what's the spread, how fast is it, and we might want to put a break on, you know, legalizing marijuana and saying we can't do any better than treat the addicted. We ought to pay more attention to stopping these poisons at our borders and at their sources outside our borders.
Did you see the article on Massachusetts now surpassing Colorado in terms of drug use among young people?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing. But also the other thing I would just say about that is what's happening with things like fentanyl and overdose deaths is that for the first time, that's having a tremendous impact on middle-aged people, that there's a bunch of kind of relapsing to both behavior views and also the expansion here. So it's terrible to see what's happening to young people, of course, because we know that has an effect on their lives for the rest of their lives. Even if they stop using, they're more susceptible to addiction and abuse. But also the thing we have to worry about is what's happening to people in their 30s to 50s to 55. That's part of the death rate that's lowering the life expectancy of Americans today.
Yeah, first time, right, in recent years that life expectancy is gotten lower, and a lot of this is explained by the drug issues, drug problems.
Yeah, I think this is also, I don't know what you feel about this, because we haven't really talked at length recently, but what's amazing to me is the lack of outrage. I mean,
I know.
Yeah, 3,000 people die on 9/11. You're over 60,000 people are dying a year. That's 20 times the number of deaths. And the argument here, I realize the problem is, well, these people are complicit in some people's minds because they take the drug. But the fact of the matter is, as you know, our culture tells young people, everybody does this. Go ahead. It's risk taking. It's daring. It takes the people who are creative. It takes the people who are willing to be different. It takes the people who are disadvantaged and vulnerable. So, you know, the problem is we have a culture that teaches people, look at marijuana legalization, it's okay to use this, but then we have this death rate that doesn't seem to put brakes on this trend, or doesn't tell us, look, this is really mass poisoning. This is really killing Americans. Look, a lot of the stuff's coming from China. It means that either China doesn't care that their people are poisoning Americans, or is complicit in why should they stop something that's causing us to unravel. In either case, if we had a group of people who were poisoning Chinese, we would not have the same posture vis-a-vis China.
What do we do? What do we need to do? I've asked you this before. You've answered it before. What do we need to do?
Yeah, well, again, I look at this, given the tremendous acceleration, historic levels of death we've had now and we're facing, I have changed my mind. And we used to talk about we need to always remain balanced. And certainly we need to talk about prevention, and we need to talk about treating people. You and I both have fought hard for a lot of these programs and funding for them. But we're not going to stop this by building shock trauma centers, as we used to say. We're not going to stop terror by building shock trauma centers, and we're not going to stop this epidemic by building emergency rooms to treat the overdose victims. We got to stop the poison, and that means we have to go after this from abroad, and we have to tell these countries in no uncertain terms they're going to stop it, or we're going to use proportional pressure on them, including things like trade and other things where they're vulnerable. I think we have to do a much better job at the border. I am somebody who thinks a wall is helpful. It's not the be-all and end-all because of the volume of material and so forth. But the fact of the matter is most drugs killing Americans come from outside the United States. Most of them come across the southwest border, marketed by Mexican gangs, at least at the central stage. And most of them pass within 6 feet of a uniformed federal agent when they come across the border. That's a monumental failure of intelligence and operations. And then we need to focus our local efforts, so the source, transit, and then local efforts to sanitize areas that are hard hit, get the drug dealers off the streets, get the people who need it into treatment, and help them stay in treatment by getting the drugs away from them, and then move out from the heavy affected areas outward. Break this network. It's a network phenomenon like terror. You got to take a big enough hunk out of it and keep it out of it so it can't repair itself and heal. But we can do this. Again, terror is a needle in a haystack problem. One or two guys, small amount of substance. We solve that problem every day. We're never sure, but every day we solve that problem, we show it can be done. Drugs, as you know and I know, is a pickup truck in a haystack. Big, big problem. We can take big bites out of that, not maybe to zero, but it's ridiculous to say that we can't cut this in half or in three quarters or in nine-tenths if we put the resources and the capacities we have on it. We're just not doing that.
Let me ask you then again a last question, and we thank you. And your passion shows and your conviction, and of course your record speaks very well for you as well. But if we care about that and we want to do all those things, again, what's the connection? Why should I be opposed to the legalization of marijuana if I'm interested in doing the things you just said? What's the connection? Why is the legalization of marijuana not helpful in this larger fight?
Well, in simplest terms, we confirm what we always do, that marijuana is the starting point for most of the people who end up dying. If the bottom of the funnel is death and addiction's in like the middle of the funnel, the top of the funnel is initiation. And yes, people initiate in different ways, but most of the people who get into trouble, especially today, start with marijuana. And we are opening the top of the funnel wider than it's ever been with legalization, when we are facing the biggest death toll down the line. And also the marijuana they're now exposed to is more potent, therefore more addictive, has more, we know more about its damage. But marijuana is also the single biggest cause of treatment need still. I mean, people want to pretend like it's a soft drug, it's not, but more people come in for treatment for marijuana than most other illegal drugs, even now with the change to opioids and fentanyl.
Yeah, it's also, as you said earlier, it's that looser environment. Looser environment externally, internally, the interest in, trying something new, experimenting, the appeal of getting high and so on. And this is common to both. But when you have an environment where it's more permissive, more loosey-goosey, that opens you up to all sorts of problems, all sorts of risks, all sorts of dangers.
Yeah, it's hard to have a prevention message because it's drowned out or it's in conflict with joking around. Everybody does it. Celebrities do it. So I'm for prevention messages. But look, we're watching people die and go into emergency rooms every day on the news. I don't know how much harder a prevention messaging you have than that. People are still using and dying.
Well done, John. Thank you very much. Thanks. Wish there were more voices like yours. We appreciate it very much. Stay at it, my friend.
Thank you. You too, Bill. Thank you. Best to the family.
That was John Walters, COO of the Hudson Institute and Director of Hudson Institute Political Studies.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Time to turn our focus to the war on terror. How are we doing? Joining us now is Tom Joslin, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and Senior Editor at the Long War Journal. Tom Joslin.
Bill, how are you doing?
Tom, good. Good to talk to you. It's been a while.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much. What I want to talk about, and what I've been thinking about, and then this article appeared, and you're quoted in it, is whatever happened to ISIS. And from the article I'm reading, where did this appear?
I don't know. I'm quoted in about 10 different things over the last week, so I'm not sure which one. So,
all right.
We've been, a lot of our sort of analysis and predictions are sort of coming true, unfortunately. So
yeah,
we were very clear that ISIS had not been defeated whatsoever, and that the territorial land grab was sort of step one in a multi-step process. And there were, unfortunately, people in the Trump administration, including the president himself, were looking to celebrate, you know, once the land grab was done. And that's just part of the overall story. And ISIS certainly knew that they were going to lose the land. They had a forced preservation sort of policy put in place, and they made sure they were going to fight on as insurgents and sort of their style of guerrilla warfare, and that's exactly what they've done.
All right, let me go through this if you have a few minutes. The headline
sure.
is, as many as 30,000 ISIS fighters may still be crawling across Iraq and Syria, as many as at the height of their power. True?
No, it's not as many as at the height of their power. So a couple of things. One, we don't actually know how many fighters are in ISIS. These estimates should all be taken with a grain of salt. This is something we've been warning about for a long time, that these body counts, whether of the dead or the living, nobody really knows.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of uncertainty involved. But the point is that even this estimate, which is apparently so you have two estimates. You have one by the U.S. government and DOD that came out through an inspector general's report, and you have a second one through the U.N. And they're basically in the same ballpark, which is that ISIS has, you know, 20 to 30,000 or so fighters in Iraq and Syria. We don't think that that's that far off. That's not the peak number. They had many, many more at the peak of their power than they do now.
What was the number? Yes.
Nobody really knows, but I think that they conservatively had between 50 and 100,000 probably total.
Okay.
And maybe even more, although it's tough to say. So there's two things. One, they still have this, tens of thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria. They very quickly, decided to switch to insurgency guerrilla warfare, which we've been monitoring. They carry out, just to put this in perspective, Bill, they carry out attacks every day in Iraq and Syria, every day across multiple battlefields in Iraq and Syria. So now the second part of this dimension, which has to be factored in, which is that they're an international organization. So they're not just based in Iraq and Syria, but they in fact have strong, what they call provinces in several different countries, including Afghanistan, Libya, the Sinai Peninsula, and elsewhere. And this, when you factor that in, you realize that they have far more left in the tank than people are giving them credit for.
Have we hurt them, though? Have we, two-part or three-part question, have we hurt them? We have, I take it from what you said, diminished their numbers. And what other way have we significantly damaged them? Is the hope of the caliphate now dimmer than it was?
Yeah, we've absolutely hurt them. We've discredited the idea of a territorial caliphate in Iraq and Syria to a certain extent. They've certainly suffered a lot of leadership losses, and there's been a constant battle to stop their plotting in the West, which is a big deal. Stopping their plots in the West, and saving either Europeans or Americans. I mean, that's a big factor. However, the way I would put this is sort of as a portly fellow who likes his food. Let me put it this way. Think back to before 2013, if the jihadi pie, let's say the jihadists were a pizza, right? Their pizza was basically a sort of a medium to large size pizza as of 2012, 2013. After that, they became basically two extra large pizzas. And so what we've done is we've taken out a number of slices from one of the pies, but there's still the Sunni jihad, the overall movement of Sunni jihadist ideology with these two leading organizations, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, don't forget Al-Qaeda, are still very much in the game, and they still have more fighters, far more fighters today overall than, let's say, on 9/11 or even as of 2011.
Really? Okay. Well, yeah, you said don't forget Al-Qaeda. What should we think of that? I mean, what numbers would we put on Al-Qaeda?
Al-Qaeda is much larger than it was on 9/11. They've expanded greatly, and they were constantly underestimated, and the rise of ISIS sort of overshadowed them in some ways. But Al-Qaeda has a very different strategy for waging jihad than ISIS. ISIS, everywhere they go, they plant a flag, they put out a video, and they say, here we are. Even if they have just one guy in the middle of the desert, they're broadcasting their presence. Al-Qaeda could raise a whole guerrilla army and not tell you it's Al-Qaeda, because that's what they've done in Afghanistan, where they're fighting embedded in the Taliban-led insurgency. The principal goal of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan today is to resurrect the Taliban, so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. We have many reasons to believe, Bill, I'm sure you've seen in the news, this raid in Ghazni, the city of Ghazni in Afghanistan, which was a catastrophe for local forces, right? There are many indications that Al-Qaeda was directly involved in that and was helping the Taliban execute that. Al-Qaeda has a significant presence of several thousand fighters in Yemen alone. They still have thousands of fighters likely in Syria, North Africa, West Africa. They are hunting French and Western forces throughout West Africa. So Al-Qaeda's presence is broadly misunderstood. They also have a big presence in East Africa and Shabab and Somalia. They're not very well understood, but when you actually look at the whole picture, what you realize is that Al-Qaeda grew into this much larger organization than it was on 9/11, although they planted the seeds in some ways before 9/11 for this. They've been able to exploit different political vacuums and the lack of central governance in several countries, and they've expanded greatly their insurgency footprint. ISIS, don't forget, grew out of Al-Qaeda. ISIS was a regional branch of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. There's some dispute over this in sort of the expert community, but I think the evidence is clear that the head of the predecessor to ISIS was loyal to the head of Al-Qaeda. And what happened was that basically the head of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, decided that he no longer wanted to be a captain in this sort of mafioso scheme. He wanted to be the Don. And so he basically defied the Don, the head of Al-Qaeda, and broke off and did his own thing. But a lot of what ISIS has done, sort of, Al-Qaeda primed the pump for that and is still very much in the game.
All right. I want to come back to this question of the harm we have done to them. In a couple of ways. What was the verb that Mattis used? We're going to annihilate them? Was that the verb?
That's something similar to that. And that's absolutely not the case. They've not been annihilated.
Failure on our part?
I mean, it depends on how much you really want to fight them. I mean, here's the trade-off, Bill, in all this. The implicit trade-off that nobody wants to make explicit, but let's make it explicit. The bottom line is the U.S. government and the elite have calculated that none of these fights are worth significant U.S. ground forces. And that's understandable because you limit casualties and you don't want to waste blood and treasure on it. I get it. Believe me, you want to use proxies everywhere you can. But that comes with a cost, because if you're not going to really hammer them all out and really make sure that they don't live to fight another day, then you're going to allow, because of the proxy warfare is so messy and creates all sorts of different problems, what that ends up allowing is that basically some of their forces are able to slip away. In fact, a significant number of their forces are able to slip away. And that's why these latest estimates you see coming out of the UN and the U.S. about the number of ISIS fighters in Iraq and Syria strike me as more or less in the ballpark, because what happened here is that they knew that our proxy forces, with special forces assistance from us in our bombing campaign, they knew we were rolling into town. They prepared for it. They're not stupid. They didn't sit there and let all their guys die, and they decided to preserve enough forces to keep waging guerrilla warfare.
Okay, it's a complicated picture as you're describing it. So maybe fewer fighters in Iraq and Syria, but still a lot, and growth overall from 9/11 and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, if I heard you correctly, right?
Yeah, I mean both. I mean, if you're talking, I don't think there are really good estimates, a really good way of knowing the total number of fighters, but I would not doubt that it's over 100,000 between the two globally, and maybe even significantly north of that.
All right. Well, then one of the questions, of course, is how the one you just answered, how much are you prepared to risk? How many of your own men and blood and treasure are you prepared to risk to annihilate them? But second question is, over the last couple of years, over the Trump presidency, I guess, is the threat to us, to the homeland, to individual citizens in America or in Europe, disaggregate the question if you want, greater or lesser?
You know, that's tough to say, because there's an ebb and flow to these threats. The truth of the matter is that you have the offensive capabilities, which in certain ways President Trump did take the gloves off in certain ways. So I'll give you one example. In Afghanistan, under Obama, the rules of engagement for fighting the Taliban, which itself, by the way, has 50 to 60,000 fighters, maybe many more, and Hezbollah, by the way, is still deeply closely allied with Al Qaeda. So, okay. You know, this is where I, what do I say when you say globally, when you count this thing properly, you realize there are well over 100,000 actually, you know, jihadis still fighting in the game. But in any event, you know, the rules of engagement were changed in Afghanistan to make sure the U.S. could conduct more offensive operations against the Taliban, go after their narcotics facilities, that sort of thing. It served the central contradiction of the Afghan war is that people say, well, it's the longest war. Correct. But the U.S. throughout much of our presence there, not the entire time, but much of our presence there, has decided that the primary adversary, the Taliban, which again is allied with Al-Qaeda, is not worthy of a direct fight. That we're not going to actually try and military defeat them. I just want to crystallize that for you, Bill. Think about this. The U.S. has decided a long time ago that we're not going to try to militarily defeat the Taliban in Afghanistan, and yet we are waging war there. This is sort of absurd. So what the assumption in all this is that basically we're going to build up the Afghan forces and eventually they're going to get good enough to beat the Taliban. Well, as we look right now and you know, at the picture, it doesn't look like we're anywhere close to that. And of course we aren't when you see the events in Ghazni and elsewhere. But this is something where the changes that President Trump made were sort of at the margin of that whole strategy, that basically there were some improvements for sure over what President Obama had done in the latter years of his administration.
Like
changing rules of engagement, you know, making sure the Americans can go after, you know, more Taliban targets, their narcotics facilities, more networks, you know, increasing the bombings on certain locations. You know, I think the National Security Council and the White House has taken a tougher line on Pakistan, which, you know, may help a little bit behind closed doors. But overall, the central contradiction remains. We are fighting a war where we've decided that we're not going, we don't think that we can militarily or should militarily defeat a principal adversary. And once you have that central contradiction in place, that's why you have America's longest war, I would argue.
All right, but apart from being the longest war, let me push you a little on this point, the last question that I asked, which is maybe the longest war, but even though it's going on and it's kind of a contradiction, as you say, is this a serious threat to the lives of American citizens in their beds at night, our failure to fight that war in Afghanistan in the way that you think we should?
Well, it's a good question. I think a lot of people would say no, that it isn't. I would say this. When you actually study the jihadis day in and day out, as we do, and follow them and track them, you realize that Al-Qaeda's central goal now, and has been for many years, has been to resurrect the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. This is the totalitarian state that the Taliban ruled over prior to 9/11, lost in late 2001, but has been working to resurrect since then. And they're closer to resurrecting it. They're still not there, of course, but they're closer to resurrecting it today than they have been. Now, I ask you this, Bill. The defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan empowered a whole generation of jihadists, and Al-Qaeda took credit for that in ways that were sort of disingenuous, but still there was something to be said to say that the jihadists actually did defeat the Soviets, the superpower in Afghanistan. Let me ask you this. What do you think it will do to the next generation of jihadists if they're able to declare victory over the U.S. this time around? They've already been priming that pump, and they've been saying that for quite some time. And so I think there are a lot of – and here's the other thing that's not factored into our assessment at all. I just gave you a brief rhetorical sort of map of where Al-Qaeda is around the globe. Guess what? All those presences from West Africa all the way to South Asia, including throughout the Middle East and the Arabian Peninsula, they all look to Afghanistan to an Al-Qaeda victory as something that would be a great source of not just comfort, but would embolden them in ways that are hard to calculate. And so, yes, this is absolutely an issue that matters to Americans sleeping in their beds at night. I just want to give you one last fact. Days before President Trump was elected in 2016, this went widely unreported or unnoticed. Just days before he was elected in 2016, the U.S. killed a very senior Al-Qaeda operative in Afghanistan who was planning attacks on the continental United States and Europe from Afghan soil all those years after 9/11. And that potential is still there, that they are still plotting it. Now the potential has grown in other areas, too, so it's not unique in that regard. But this terrain is unique in terms of the overall ideological movement and what it would do for them, both organizationally and in terms of the war of ideas.
Do you have any sense of whether the limited engagement, I'm calling it that, not a term of art, just my own vocabulary, that we're involved in Afghanistan and elsewhere, is a function of the president's decision or the military's recommendation, or do they concur?
Look, I think President Trump came in sort of, and he said this, he didn't really want to fight this war. He didn't really want to be in Afghanistan, and that's partly understandable. I can't entirely blame him there. There's been a lot of incompetence leading up to this. But what I would say is that The Defense Department and other parts of the U.S. government, I honestly mean what I'm about to say. I think they have behaved shamefully in this war, and they have not prosecuted in a way that is forceful or honest. And they have concocted all sorts of talking points to justify the fact that they're not really trying to defeat the main enemy in Afghanistan.
Why?
And when you pick it,
why?
Because they are, there's just broad intellectual and moral confusion is the only way I can put it. I'll give you one fact that I've run into in my meetings in D.C. and elsewhere, in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. The number of Taliban apologists, these are quote-unquote analysts for the American government, who are de facto apologists for the Taliban is stunning. And in fact, I had a very senior administration official who worked directly for President Trump tell me that many of the analysts that he was engaging and having to listen to acted as de facto Taliban apologists. And I said, that doesn't surprise me because we've seen this intellectual rot in the U.S. government on these issues and that there's not any clarity or focus on what this group is and who they are and what their alliance with Al-Qaeda, how that survived after all these years of war. So this is somebody who works for the President of the United States telling me that the analysis that he was getting was as if it was crafted by de facto Taliban apologists and that the analysis he was getting was no different from Taliban press releases.
Good Lord.
Just think about that, Bill.
How can you be a Taliban apologist in the United States government? What does that mean?
I mean, these are people.
Well, but what's the case to be made for? What case? Make believe you're a Taliban apologist.
Okay. The case is rotten. Okay, it's just a bunch of lies. But I'll give you one. I'll give you just the key lie, the main lie, and you can see this in a recent Defense Department report, is that there's no strategic alliance between Al Qaeda and the Taliban. That the two are wholly separate, almost, and that there's just some overlap at the lower mid level ranks, and then overall they're not really closely allied, and we shouldn't consider the Taliban as a key al-Qaeda ally to this day. Well, this is utter rubbish. You can look at Long War Journal and the article I just put up based on the UN's assessment, which we concur with, which just said that the al-Qaeda's alliance with the Taliban remains firm and they're closely allied. Those two phrases come from a recent UN report. And there are many reasons why that's true. But, you know, the fact that here's the point. If you don't really want to be in Afghanistan and you don't really want to have to try and defeat the Taliban and fight this messy war, well, then it becomes intellectually convenient to assume away the worst relationship that you have to calculate, which is that the Taliban and al-Qaeda remain allied. And so there's all sorts of hoops these people jump through in order to justify this.
Tell us, just in closing, if you're General Jocelyn, President Jocelyn, what do you do? Start with Afghanistan. Do you commit all the way or do you get out or what do you do?
Well, I'll say this. I can't, and this is where I'm a little bit sympathetic to President Trump on this. You can't correct all the mistakes of the past. For nearly 17 years now, for much of that time, I've argued against some of the policy decisions that were made and said I would have done something differently. I can't own all those mistakes, but I certainly would not run from this fight. I would commit more resources to it. And I think when you properly identify the enemy and understand who the enemy is and what's going on here and the actual threats to the United States, you realize that they're much greater than a lot of people want to assume. So I would fight that fight. And I would not be as hesitant, I would not be as hesitant to use more American troops in some of these theaters. That's something that a lot of people would disagree with. I understand their disagreements. I understand they have valid points for not wanting to do that. I'm just saying that I take this threat probably more seriously than most, and I want to finish them off and come home. And what's unfortunate, I think, is that we keep fighting these wars in a manner that means they get to live another day. And that's I want to end that.
I got it. Yeah. See, I think the assumption, and one of the reasons we turn to you, Tom, the main reason we turn to you, is that I think a lot of Americans were thinking they're out of the news, so they're out of the picture. But they're not out of the picture, even though they may end up being in the news. Attention must be paid. Continuing attention must be paid.
Right. I mean, the old saying goes that the greatest trick that the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist or something along those lines.
Right.
Well, I mentioned Al-Qaeda throughout this interview. Guess what? That was basically their policy in several different places. And they got away with it mainly because the Obama administration was willing to pretend that the 9/11 wars were over and that Al-Qaeda was decimated and on the path to defeat, a shadow of its former self, all these sort of catchphrases we heard. Meanwhile, not only was the rise of ISIS percolating, but Al-Qaeda was expanding greatly too. And so all I can say to people is, as a nerd who follows this on a day in and day out basis, just watch out, because they are in places now and have a larger force in countries now than they certainly did on 9/11 and that they did even in 2011.
All right. Well, I don't think you're a nerd, but if you want to call yourself a nerd, you're a great nerd and a nerd we need.
Well, I use nerd in a positive sense. Some people don't like it, but whatever.
No, I like it. You're the go-to guy. That's another way of saying the nerd. Okay. Thanks, Tom, very much. Thank you, sir. We appreciate
it. Thanks, Bill.
That was Tom Joslin, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies and Senior Editor at the Long War Journal.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show. Bill Bennett Show.
And now let's totally change direction and talk a little college football. Joining me now is Phil Steele, creator of the Phil Steele College Football Preview magazine. He's an ESPN insider. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Bill, how the heck are you?
Okay, the question is, how are you? This is your season, man.
Oh, yeah, doing great. You know what? It's going to be a lot of fun. We got football kicking off this weekend. And while there are just a couple of nondescript games, I'll be watching every minute of them and enjoying it.
When does your magazine, the great magazine, come out? When is the first edition out?
We send it to the printer right at the end of May, and it usually hits the newsstands right before July 4th. So it takes about a month to get the whole thing turned around.
Right, but you write it at the end of May, and now it's the end of August, and the June and July, and that's 3 months. What's changed since you wrote it up? What's changed?
You know, not much. And that's one of the reasons that we go out so late, Bill. Everybody else is hitting the newsstands. You see the other magazines on the newsstands in May, for crying out loud. I wait till the end of May, and then what I do is I try to talk to as many of the head coaches as I can. And this year, I talked to over 100 of the head coaches, and they were all post-spring exit interviews. So they've had their post-spring exit interviews, and some of the coaches will tell me, hey, you know, this guy's going to transfer, this guy's going to be gone, this guy's going to be gone, he didn't like what he heard. So I got a lot of the transfers out of the way by waiting until the end of May rather than putting out my magazine while spring practices are still going on like the other guys.
Let's talk about a few teams that are listed. One thing I noticed, is this just my imagination? But it seems to me there's been a kind of shift. Maybe it's the Vegas money, I don't know, but a shift toward Clemson. Do I have it right? You had Alabama 1, Clemson 2, is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is there kind of a move toward Clemson? I see some more sentiment toward Clemson. Now, why would that be if that's true?
It's because the Alabama linebacking corps has been taking some hits spring. So far this spring, they have lost Keith Holcomb, I just had him as a third stringer, but that's some depth. Vandarius Cowan was dismissed from the team. He was my number 4 rated linebacker out of high school. I had him a second stringer. Terrell Lewis got injured. He was my number 7 rated running linebacker out of high school. He's Mel Kiper's 5th rated junior outside linebacker. He's gone. Christopher Allen, most likely gone for the season. He was a top rated recruit and one of the backups. So the linebacking corps took some big hits depth-wise. And everybody remembers last year when Alabama got their linebacking corps banged up at the end of the year. They struggled against Mississippi State and then lost to Auburn. Mm-hmm. They got the linebackers healthy and dispatched Clemson in the playoffs. So I think that is a little bit of a concern. But all the starters are still there, and they still have some talented backups.
Who's going to walk out at quarterback?
It's going to be Tua Tagovailoa.
It is.
All the talk about it being really a quarterback competition, I'm not buying it. I think you have to keep your backup quarterback interested nowadays, keep them in the mix so that they don't transfer. And I think Nick Saban's played it correctly. And the fact that Jalen Hurts has not transferred gives them one of the best quarterback situations in college football. Yeah. I mean, if something happens to Tua, the guy coming off the bench is 26-2 as a starter and had a 17-1 ratio last year. That's a pretty good backup quarterback coming in.
Even with those linebacker injuries, Phil, would you still have Alabama number 1?
Yeah, I would. You know, you look at some of the backup linebackers, they may be young, but I think by the end of the season they'll be fine. And when you look at Alabama's schedule this year, they figure to be a double-digit favorite in every single game they play. Maybe the one exception may be the Iron Bowl, where right now in Vegas they're a 9-point favorite. But keep in mind, 2 weeks prior, Auburn are probably coming off a loss to Georgia on the road, now having played in Alabama on the road. So there is the potential where this year Alabama could be a double-digit favorite in every game, and I think they'll get that linebacking corps sorted out, provided they don't lose anybody else.
Mississippi State is a kind of dangerous game for them, is it not?
Well, last year it was. You know, the fact that they were in Starkville and barely escaped with a 7-point win. But I think this year they get Mississippi State at home, which is a big thing. And they'll be well prepared, especially after a close game last year. I personally have them a 3-touchdown favorite in that game.
Okay, now my mistake. I was probably thinking of last year. Is there another game that would be close to less than 2 digits?
The only one would be the only two would be Auburn and then maybe LSU. And the LSU game is on the road. That's generally pretty close. Right now, Alabama's about a 13-point favorite in that game.
Okay. Let's take a look at that. Not this weekend. I guess we have some. Yeah, what should we watch this weekend, Phil? I looked down the roster. I said, no, not that interesting. Are there any games of interest? Do I watch? Is it UMass against Duquesne or something? There's something.
Yeah.
I don't mean to disparage anybody. I don't mean
to disparage. Gotcha. Yeah, Rice is playing Prairie View. And, you know, the big thing with Rice, new head coach, we'll see how they open up the season. They need to open it up strong. UMass is one of those teams that it was much better than their record last year. I think that they've got a quarterback that you need to watch because he's one of the underrated quarterbacks in the country, and I think he'll light up Duquesne in the starter. Wyoming's got a big test at New Mexico State. Remember, New Mexico State got to their first bowl game since 1960 last year, and they get that game at home, so that'll be a fun one to watch and probably the most intriguing of the weekend. And then Colorado State figures to be a big favorite over Hawaii, but Colorado State's head coach Mike Bobo had to take a leave of absence, so he won't be there for this game, and that number dropped from 3 touchdowns down to 2 touchdowns because of that.
All right, well, we're here in North Carolina, and they make a big deal. We have a little place here in North Carolina. They make a big deal on Labor Day. They have an end-of-summer party and all that, and there's an expression around my house now. I say, honey, I'm doing a Phil Steele day. Not available. Not available. That's Saturday, September 1. What are we looking at that day?
We are looking at some great games on Saturday, and you know, probably to me the biggest game going on the entire day would be Washington against Auburn. Washington is a team that I'm projecting to make the playoffs, but they really need to beat Auburn in the opener. The game is in Atlanta, so Auburn's going to have the home field edge. If Auburn has a question mark, it'd be along the offensive line. I think Washington's defensive line is good enough to do it, but that's going to be a game where I think if Auburn beats Washington, the Pac-12 might not get a team in the playoffs once again. I'm going to be intrigued, Bill, by watching West Virginia and Tennessee. I mean, Tennessee's got a new sheriff in town. West Virginia's one of the preseason favorites to win the Big 12, but Tennessee's now in a large underdog role. They're actually a 10-point dog in that game. Will Greer is the quarterback to watch because he's one of the tops in the country, so that's going to be a fun one. And then how about Michigan and Notre Dame? Notre Dame, I think, opens it up. One of those two teams, whoever wins that game, legitimate national title contender, and the loser takes a big hit to their potential playoff hope.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a fun one to watch. And Michigan's a lot more experienced than last year, and the game's in South Bend. And that one's at 7:30 at night on NBC.
I reread your commentary on Notre Dame. Repeat a little of it for the audience. You think they're a real possibility. Did you have them like some like number 8 or something? I think it was like number 8 preseason. But they could, if they win that game, they could keep going. I looked at their schedule. There's not that much in their way, is there?
Yeah, that's probably the big game. It's not an easy schedule, but it's a manageable schedule for Notre Dame. And here's what I like about the Irish. Last year, they were coming off a 4-win season. I had them my number one most improved team in the country. And the Irish did just that. They improved to 10 wins. They were, at one point, they were number 3 in the country at the end of the year in November and favored at Miami of Florida. Now, they lost 2 of their last 4 games. They lost at Miami. They lost at Stanford. Now they're off the radar. But here's why I like Notre Dame this year. 9 returning starters on defense. Brandon Winbush back at QB. And from all reports, he's a much improved passing quarterback. He was a dangerous runner last year. Lacked a little bit in reading the defenses. I think he's going to be improved this year. The offensive line is solid. And I like the skill players. And then you look at their schedule. Their 4 road games this year are all in the winnable category. We're talking about Wake Forest, Northwestern, Virginia Tech, and USC. I've got them favored in all 4 road games. They get Michigan at home, which is huge. They get Stanford at home, and they also get Florida State at home in November when it figures to be cold. So if they do get past Michigan in the opener, I would have Notre Dame favored in all their other 11 games, and I've got them as my number one surprise team or a non-top 10 team that I think can contend for the playoffs.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that is it. That is a huge game for both teams. Tell us about Florida State. Are they recovering?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, last year Florida State wasn't quite as bad as that team that needed to reschedule Louisiana at the end of the year and get right. themselves that sixth win to get to a bowl game. In fact, you look at some of Florida State's losses last year. The Alabama game in the opener, they actually were only outgained 269 to 250, and they lost their starting quarterback. Even without their quarterback, they lose to NC State by six. The Miami of Florida game, Miami gets a touchdown on the last play of the game to pull out the win. The Louisville game, it's tied at 28. Florida State's got the ball deep in Louisville territory, setting up for the game-winning field goal. They fumble. Louisville drives down, gets the game-winning field goal, and beats them. Later against Clemson in Death Valley, against a Clemson team that was number one at the end of the regular season, they were down by 3 points in the fourth quarter with 6 minutes to go and had the ball on Clemson's side of the field. So they weren't getting blown out in games, yeah. with the exception of Boston College. And Willie Taggart likes what he's inherited this year. They've got a lot of talent on hand. They get France back at QB, one of the best running back cores in the country. The offensive line should be the best it's been in years, and defensively there's good talent. And they get Clemson at home. That makes them a little bit of a dark horse contender. And believe it or not, Bill, the Vegas over-under on Florida State's wins for the season is 7.5. I'm going over on that one.
Really? Interesting. Interesting. Wow. Wow. Talk about some other Florida teams like UCF.
Yeah, UCF, you know, they actually have a better chance this year of making the playoffs than they did last year. If they were to run the table and have a 27-game win streak, I think that they would be in the conversation.
Are they a better team than last year?
I don't think they're a better team. They lose their head coach. They also lose a lot on defense, including Shaquem Griffin,
who to me was one
of the more underrated defensive players in the country.
Great.
They do have Mackenzie Milton back at QB. They do have an explosive offense, but a new head coach, and now they go from being the hunter to the hunted. Everybody's going to be shooting for UCF this year, and the Vegas win total on them is surprisingly just 9. Another Florida team to talk about. Let's talk about the University of Florida, and I think of all the first-year head coaches this year, Dan Mullen steps into the best situation of anyone. Last year, everything that could go wrong went wrong for Florida. It started in August. They suspended 10 players, including their top running back, top receiver from the 2016, a good portion of depth of the offensive, defensive lines, and linebacker. Then during the season, they suffered a myriad of injuries. In fact, at one point in November, they were down 28 scholarship players were out, either due to injuries or suspensions. That's over a 30-year roster. They won just 4 games. Well, this year, 19 returning starters. And here's a little thing about Dan Mullen. At Mississippi State, every year, Bill, I picked them 6th or 7th in the SEC West. Bulldog fans will tell you that. And every year they finished above my expectations. So I think he gets the most out of his talent. He's proven to be a quarterback whisperer. He always got the most out of these 2-star and 3-star quarterbacks.
Yeah,
he's got talent and quarterback to work with. And then you look at the schedule for Florida this year. You know, they only have 3 true SEC road games. One's against Tennessee, one's against Vanderbilt, and the other one's against Mississippi State, a team that Dan Mullen knows the personnel inside and out.
Yeah,
so they've got a chance of winning all 3 road games. They get the other games in the swamp with the exception of Georgia. I've got them my number one most improved team this year, much like Notre Dame was last year.
Very interesting. I want to come back to Central Florida for a minute because if they run the table, they're a contender for playoffs because, and this is kind of an oddity, people will remember last year's bowl game, right?
Right. I think that would be a factor. Yeah, and I think the fact they went 13-0 last year, beat Auburn in the bowl game,
right.
and would have run the table again this year, so they'd be 26-0 the last 2 years. I think they would get legitimate contender status to make in the playoffs. Now, that'll happen? It's the negative for UCF this year is the fact that they don't play a ranked team all season long.
I was going to say, is there a game on the schedule that tells us this is a really good team, really good team?
Yeah, I mean, the toughest 3 road games are North Carolina, which suffered some depletions, and they get them early in the year when North Carolina's going to be down a bunch of suspended players. Memphis is on the road and USF is on the road. So no marquee wins on the road or even marquee games at home for that matter.
Okay, that'd be very, very, very interesting. All right, listen, we need to let you go, and we how many interviews you have lined up in the next 2 weeks? How many?
uh, Probably not as many as I do during the summer. During the summer, Bill, I'm doing like eight shows a day.
Wow.
Sort of cut it down a little bit prior to the season, trying to get all my power ratings finalized. But I stay busy.
Well, I'm telling you, it's so good to hear your voice again this summer. We've had you on twice now. It's great. And so ends my purgatory. I say that as a Catholic. Football, college football is back. And will we see you on ESPN?
Well, you can read my stuff every week on ESPN The Insider. I write a bunch of different articles
for that. Sure.
And then possibly we'll do some sports centers again this year. I don't think we'll be doing as many as last year, but definitely be in the mix this year.
Great. Well, we rely on you, Phil, and we're very grateful to you. And the audience loves this as a change of pace from our usual stuff. So anyway, your tweets are non-controversial. I'll just leave it at that. How's that?
There you go. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Phil. Happy season to you.
Yeah, great talking to you again, my friend.
That was Phil Steele. He's the creator of the Phil Steele College Football Preview Magazine, The Best, and he's an ESPN insider.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
I wanted to save my comments till you heard Tom Joslin and John Walters. Deadly serious topics with Tom and John. You know, more fun and games, literally, with Phil. But I just wanted to talk about our two principal guests there, because it was interesting. John Walters, in talking about drugs, talked about comparing it with terrorism. Tom Joslin was a wake-up call, Claude, I thought. I mean, I you know, we have talked about how we have smashed ISIS and Al-Qaeda, et cetera, and Taliban, but they're still out there. They're still out there. You read the papers, you watch the news, you see they're going like crazy in Afghanistan. And they're still out there. They're scattered, you know. We've blown up the major nests, but they're all around the place, still causing tremendous harm. And we need to keep pressing, just keep pressing in this effort. It's a wake-up, what Tom Joslin had to say. And I trust he is talking to this administration, which seems at least attentive to the real needs. And he did praise them, didn't he, Claude, for the rules of engagement, for making the rules of engagement different so our guys can get the job done. On the drug issue, I can't add to John's insight. He's the guy I go to. He was my deputy, but then he succeeded me after George W. Bush was elected president. And I think follows it, tracks it closer than anyone. And all I can do is just say kudos and ditto to what he said. We got to get a handle on this, and how many people have to die and go into treatment before we say we got to stop this stuff from coming in. We got to get after this poison, keep it out of the hands of our children, keep it out of the hands of adults, as John was saying. More to be done, more to be said. This death toll keeps going up every year. 72,000 last year. Come on, it's more than Vietnam. That's, you know, a lot more than drunken driving and highway deaths. Come on, let's get at it. John Brennan. I watched this Fuhrer with John Brennan. I'm sorry, I just don't see it. This guy violated a kind of code that these agency directors, intelligence agency directors, have. You leave your politics at the door when you come in and when you leave. And he put himself in a very political position. Made it easy and justifiable for the president to revoke his security clearances. Even the suggestion and his accusations that people said, gee, he says with real confidence, you know, the president was colluding with the Russians, as if to give authority to it because of his role as CIA director. That's not right. That's not right to do that. And I think the president was right to thump him. Not much of a thump, you know. He's not really, you know, going to have access to stuff, but most of these guys don't once they leave. Who's going to call John Brennan back or others? There's a long list of people that the president then apparently has decided he's going to look at. We'll see it on the merits. I mean, it may be very meritorious to revoke the security clearance for Bruce Orr, the number four guy in justice. But, you know, this is what you have presidents for, to take executive action like this, and I think he was right to do it. Do you have any comment on that, Claude, at all?
Not necessarily maybe on that, but going back to the synthetic marijuana stuff, I mean, you know, I can only imagine the scene in New Haven where you had 71 overdoses in the city in less than 24 hours, and 52 were in the New Haven Green Park. Like, do we want that to become the norm, or the possibility of that becoming normalized in America, and just wake up one day, go throughout your day in any given city, that can happen given what someone would put in marijuana. We don't need that legal, and we don't need that happening.
Yeah, I was thinking of it was called the Plotschmitz, I think. It was Needle Park in Switzerland, where you know, they said you can use whatever you want, and they finally closed it down because it became Death Park, you know. But I was thinking of that when I saw those that newsreel footage of these people. And did you read, did you follow that some of the people who were then hospitalized and given medication then were back on the park in a few hours or the next day? Well, yeah, they're addicted. You know, it's...
And you don't want that to, again, to become the norm and something that we just adjust to.
John said, you know, opening the funnel more widely. I mean, you really don't want to do that. All right, while we're in troubles, I continue to mourn about this Catholic Church stuff. I have read a lot. I don't want to repeat some of this stuff, but it's not just individual acts. It's conspiracies. It's people, groups of priests, just identifying in common people whom they could abuse, take advantage of. It's sick, sick, sick. I want to hear an atmosphere of full disclosure, not just embarrassment and apology, but that the church will come clean on all this. I hear from people who have served on these commissions, Claude, that there's still a reluctance of the church to come, you know, full clearance, full accountability, full disclosure. And we got to have that before there's anything else. Plenty to think about, plenty to do in our world, and things to worry about. But, you know, this is the last best hope of earth. We will, despite what Andrew Cuomo said. Boy, has that a career ender? Is that a career stopper?
Right.
That great. Was that great.
Like, where'd that come from?
Hello?
Yeah. Interesting.
Just he thinks he's smart and, you know, man. Is this Trump derangement syndrome? Trump just driving people to kind of insanity?
They feel like they have to say the exact opposite of everything that he says in order to
America's great. No, it isn't. Crazy, crazy.
They don't want to be mistaken for a Trumper, so they have to say everything he says, they have to say the exact opposite of in order to, you know, satisfy their inner demons, I guess. I don't know.
All right. Do you have any thoughts on anything else? Any
You know what? Well, you had mentioned, you know, spoke to Tom Joslin. There were reports late last night, and that being Monday night, today we're recording Tuesday, that U.S. officials said that they are confident that in a drone strike they killed the chief al-Qaeda bomb maker. It's just interesting because, you know, you had brought it up 2 weeks ago, like, hey, let's get Tom Joslin, let's talk about terrorism. And I thought to myself, when was the last time we've seen extensive reporting on the war on terror?
Good point.
It was a time in the country where, man, that was the only thing we talked about. Everything else seemed to be minor. You know, and now, and I get that the cycle continues, and there are other things that come up, but I mean, we have more coverage on affairs with porn stars than we do on the war on terror, and that just seems to be, this just seems to be unfocused.
Where's our attention? You know, where's our attention? Attention, attention, attention on the right things. Attention must be paid. All right. Thank you. Thank you for paying attention to our listeners, this podcast. If you want to write us with your comments, your analysis, your thoughts, your refutations, your contradictions, whatever you want to say, your exhortations to me, we'd be glad to hear them. Where do they write, Claude? Who do they send their email
to? Right. Just email BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. And we may read your stuff on the air. Is it on the air?
Yes.
On the air, the right expression?
It's on the air. It's in the cloud. It's downloaded on your tablets. It's wherever you listen.
Cloud, tablets. This is almost biblical.
Yes.
We're going back to some of the old books. Clouds, tablets.
Yeah, did you hear that? There's a joke on social media, and there's a picture of what someone says is Moses with the Ten Commandments in his hands, and says he's the first person to download a message on a tablet. It's supposed to be funny.
It's all right. It's a good place to end. No more from you.
I'm here all week.
I'm going to cut your coffee off. All right. Thanks, Claude.
No problem.
Thanks, everybody.